Chapter 4 The Shed 1 It was August 14th. A quick calculation told Gardner that he had been with Bobby for 41 days, almost exactly a biblical period of confusion or unknown time, as in he wandered in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights. It seemed longer. It seemed like his entire life. He and Bobby did no more than pick at the frozen pizza Gardner heated up for their supper. "I think I'd like a beer," Bobby said, going to the fridge. "How about you? Want one, Gard?"
"I'll pass, thanks."
Bobby raised her eyebrows, but said nothing. She got the beer, walked out on the porch, and Gardner heard the seat of her old rocker creak comfortably as she sat down. After a while, he drew a cold glass of water from the tap, went out, and sat beside Bobby. They sat there for what seemed a long time, not speaking, just looking out into the hazy stillness of early evening.
"Been a long time, Bobby, you and me," he said.
"Yes, a long time. And a strange ending."
"Is that what it is?"
Gardner asked, turning in his chair to look at Bobby.
"The end."
Bobby shrugged easily. Her eyes slid away from Gardner's. "Well, you know, end of a phase. How's that? Any better?"
"If it's le mot juste, then it's not just better. Not even the best. Just the only mot that matters. Isn't that what I taught you?"
Bobby laughed. "Yeah, it was. First damned class. Mad dogs, Englishmen, and English teachers."
"Yeah.
Yeah." Bobby sipped her beer and looked out at the old dairy road again. Impatient for them to arrive, Gardner supposed. If the two of them had really said everything there was left to say after all these years, he almost wished he had never heeded the impulse to come back at all, no matter what the reasons or eventual outcome. Such a weak ending to a relationship which had, in its time, encompassed love, sex, friendship, a period of tense détente. Concern, and even fear, seemed to make mock of the whole thing. The pain, the hurt, the effort. "I always loved you, Gard," Bobby said softly and thoughtfully, not looking at him. "And no matter how this turns out, remember that I still do." Now she did look at Gardner, her face a strange parody of a face under the thick makeup. Surely this was some hopeless eccentric who happened to resemble Bobby a little. "And I hope you'll remember that I never asked to stumble over the goddamn thing. Free will was not a factor here, as some wise ass or other has surely said."
"But you chose to dig it up,"
Gardner said. His voice was as soft as Bobby's, but he felt a new terror steal into his heart. Was that crack about free will a roundabout apology for his own impending murder? "Stop it, Gard. Stop jumping at shadows."
"Is the car buried out at the end of Mr. Road a shadow?"
His mind returned at once. Bobby laughed softly. "Man, the idea that whether or not to dig something like that up could ever be a function of free will. You might be able to stick that to a kid in a high school debate, but we out on the porch, Gard. You don't really think a person chooses something like that, do you? Do you think people can choose to put away any knowledge once they've seen the edge of it?"
"I had been picketing nuclear power plants on that assumption, yes,"
Gardner said slowly. Bobby waved it away. "Societies may choose not to implement ideas. Actually, I doubt even that, but for the sake of argument, we'll say it's so. But ordinary people? No, Gard, I'm sorry. When ordinary people see something sticking out of the ground, they got to dig on it. They got to dig on it because it might be treasure."
"And you didn't have the slightest inkling that there would be?"
Fallout was the word that came to mind. He didn't think it was a word Bobby would like.
"Consequences?"
Bobby smiled openly. "Not a hint in the world."
"But Peter didn't like it."
"No. Peter didn't like it. But it didn't kill him, Gard."
"I'm quite sure it didn't."
Peter died of natural causes. He was old. That thing in the woods is a ship from another world, not Pandora's box, not a divine apple tree. I heard no voice from heaven singing, "Of this ship shalt thou not eat, lest ye die." Guard smiled a little.
But it is a ship of knowledge, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose. Bobby was looking toward the road again, obviously not wanting to pursue the topic further.
When do you expect them?
Gardner asked. Instead of answering, Bobby nodded at the road. Kyle Archenberg's caddy was coming, followed by Adley McKean's old Ford.
Guess I'll go inside and catch some winks,
Gardner said, getting up. If you want to go out to the ship with us, you're welcome to.
With you, maybe. With them?
He cocked a thumb toward the approaching cars.
They think I'm crazy. Also, they hate my guts because they can't read my mind.
If I say you go, you go.
Well, I think I'll pass,
Gardner said, getting up and stretching.
I don't like them either. They make me nervous.
I'm sorry.
Don't be. Just tomorrow. The two of us, Bobby, right?
Right.
Give them my best. And remind them I helped. Steel plate in my head or not.
I will. Of course I will. But Bobby's eyes slid away again, and Gardner didn't like that.
He didn't like it at all.
2. He thought they might go in the shed first, but they didn't. They stood around outside for a while, talking. Bobby, Frank, Newt, Dick Allison, Hazel, the others, and then moved off toward the woods in a tight group. The light was shading down toward purple now, and most of them were carrying flashlights. Watching, Guard felt that his last real moment with Bobby had come and gone. There was nothing now but to go into the shed and see what was in there. Make up his mind once and for all.
Saw an eyeball peeping through a smoky cloud behind the green door.
He got up and went through the house to the kitchen in time to see them heading into Bobby's rampant garden. He counted noses quickly, making sure that they were all there, then headed for the cellar. Bobby kept a spare key ring down there. He opened the cellar door and paused one final time.
Do you really want to do this?
No. No, he did not, but he meant to do it. And he discovered that more than fear, he felt a great sense of loneliness. There was literally no one else he could turn to for help. He had been in the desert with Bobby Anderson 40 days and 40 nights, and now he was in the desert on his own.
God help him. To hell with it, he thought. Like the old World War I platoon sergeant was supposed to have said, "Come on, you guys, you want to live forever?"
Gardner went downstairs to get Bobby's key ring. 3. It was there, hanging on its nail with every key neatly labeled. The only catch was the shed key was gone. It had been here, he was quite sure of that. When had he last seen it here? Guard tried to remember and couldn't. Bobby taking precautions? Maybe. He stood in the new and improved workshop, sweat on his forehead and sweat on his balls. No key. That was great. So what was he supposed to do? Grab Bobby's axe and make like Jack Nicholson in The Shining? He could see it. Smash, crash, bash, here's Gardner! Except that might be a bit hard to cover up before the pilgrims came back from the viewing of the sacred hatch. He stood in Bobby's workshop, feeling time slip away, feeling old and unimproved. How long would they be out there anyway? No way of telling, was there? No way at all.
Okay, where do people put keys? Always assuming she really was just taking precautions and not just hiding it from you.
A thought struck him so hard, he actually slapped his forehead. Bobby hadn't taken the key, nor had anyone been trying to hide it. The key had disappeared when Bobby had supposedly been in Derry Home Hospital recovering from sunstroke. He was almost positive of that. And what memory would not or could not supply, logic did. Bobby hadn't been in Derry Home. She had been in the shed. Had one of the others taken the spare key to tend her when Bobby needed tending? Did they all have copies? Why bother?
No one in Haven was into sealing these days. They were into becoming. The only reason the shed was kept locked was to keep him out, so they could just... Gardner remembered watching them arrive on one of the occasions after the something had happened to Bobby, the something that had been a lot more serious than heat prostration. He closed his eyes and saw the caddy, Kyle One. They get out and...
And Archenberg splits off from the rest for a moment or two. You're up on one elbow, looking out the window at them, and if you think of it at all, you think he must have stepped around there to tap a kidney. But he didn't. He went around to get the key. Sure, that's what he did. Went around to get the key.
It wasn't much, but it was enough to get him moving. He ran back up the cellar stairs, headed for the door, then doubled back. In the bathroom, there was an ancient pair of Foster Grant's sunglasses on top of the medicine cabinet. They had come to rest up there with the finality that trivial objects manage to obtain only in a single man or woman's quarters, like the makeup which had belonged to Newt Beringer's wife. Gardner took the sunglasses down, blew a thick coating of dust from the lenses, wiped them carefully, then folded the bows and put them in his breast pocket. He went out to the shed. 4. He stood by the padlocked plank door for a moment, looking out along the path which led to the dig. Dusk had advanced far enough now so that the woods beyond the garden were a massy blue-gray with no detail to them. He saw no bobbing line of returning flashlights.
But they could turn up. At any time at all, they could turn up and catch you with your arm all the way down in the jam jar. I think they'll spend a pretty good while out there mooning over it. They've got the Cleve lights. But you don't know for sure.
No. Not for sure. Gardner shifted his gaze back to the plank door. Between the planks he could see that green light, and he could hear a dim, unpleasant noise, like an old-fashioned washing machine with a gut full of clothes and thick suds. No. Not just one washing machine. More like a whole line of them, not quite in sync. That light was pulsing in time to the low, slurping sound.
I don't want to go in there.
There was a smell. Even that, Gardner thought, was slightly sudsy, bland, with a faint hint of rancidity. Old soap. Cakey soap.
But it's no bunch of washing machines. That sounds alive. It's not telepathic typewriters inside there, not new and improved water heaters. It's something alive, and I don't want to go in there.
But he was going to. After all, hadn't he come back from the dead just to look inside Bobby's shed and catch the Tommyknockers at their strange little benches? He supposed he had. Guard went around to the far side of the shed. There, hanging on a rusty nail under the eave, was the key. He reached up with a hand that trembled and took it down. He tried to swallow. At first, he couldn't. His throat felt as if it had been coated with dry, heated flannel.
A drink. Just one drink. I'll go into the house long enough to get just one, a short peg. Then I'll be ready.
Fine. Sounded great. Except he wasn't going to do it, and he knew he wasn't. The drinking part was done, so was the delaying part. Holding the key tightly in his damp hand, Gardner went around to the door. He thought,
don't want to go in. Don't even know if I can because I'm so afraid. Stop it. Let that part be over, too. Your Tommyknocker phase.
He looked around again, almost hoping to see the line of flashlights coming out of the woods or to hear their voices.
But you wouldn't, because they talk in their heads.
No flashlights. No movements, no crickets, no birdsong.
The only sound was the sound of washing machines, the sound of amplified, leaky heartbeat. Slish, slish, slish.
Gardner looked at the pulsing green light fingering its way through the cracks between the boards. He reached into his pocket, took out the old sunglasses and put them on. It had been a long time since he had prayed. But he prayed now. It was short, but a prayer for all that. God, please. G.
Jim Gardiner said into the dim summer dusk, and slid the key into the padlock. 5. He expected a blast of head radio, but none came. Until it didn't, he hadn't realized that his stomach was tight and sucked in, like a man expecting an electric shock. He licked his lips and turned the key. A small noise, barely audible over the low, sloshing noises from the shed. Click. The hatch sprang up a little from the body of the lock. He reached for it with an arm that felt like lead. He pulled it free, clicked the hasp down, and put it into his left front pocket with the key still sticking out. He felt like a man in a dream. It was not a good one to be having. The air in there had to be okay. Well, perhaps not okay. Perhaps none of the air in Haven was exactly okay anymore. But it was about the same as the air outside, Gard thought, because the shed was a sieve of cracks. If there was such a thing as a pure Tommyknocker biosphere, this couldn't be it. At least he didn't think so. All the same, he would take as few risks as possible. He took a deep breath, held it, and told himself to count his steps.
3. You go in no more than 3 steps, just in case. 1 good look around and then out, in 1 big hurry. You hope? Yes, I hope.
He took a final look along the path, saw nothing, turned back to the shed and opened the door. The green glow, brilliant even through the dark glasses, washed over him like corrupt sunlight. 6. At first he could see nothing at all. The light was too bright. He knew it had been brighter than this on other occasions, but he had never been so close to it before. Close? God, he was in it. Someone standing just outside the open door looking for him now would hardly be able to see him. He slitted his eyes against that brilliant greenness and shuffled forward a step, then another step, then a third. His hands were held out in front of him like those of a groping blind man, which he was. Shit, he even had the dark glasses to prove it. The noise was louder, slish, 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 off to the left. He turned in that direction but didn't go any further. He was afraid to go any further, afraid of what he might touch. Now his eyes began to adjust. He saw dark shapes in the green, a bench. But no Tommyknockers at it. It had simply been shoved back against the wall, out of the way, and...
My God, it is a washing machine. It really is.
It was, all right, one of the old-fashioned kind with ringer roller at the top. But it wasn't making that weird noise. It had also been pushed back against the wall. It was in the process of being modified somehow. Someone was working on it in the best Tommyknocker tradition. But it wasn't running now. Next to it was an Electrolux vacuum cleaner, one of the old long ones that ran on wheels, low to the ground like a mechanical dachshund. A chainsaw, mounted on wheels, stacks of smoke detectors from Radio Shack, most still in their boxes. A number of kerosene drums, also on wheels, with hoses attached to them, and things like arms.
Arms? Of course they are. They're robots. Fucking robots in the making. And none of them looks exactly like the White Dove of Peace, does it, Gard? And...
Slish, slish, slish. Further left. The source of the glow was here. Gard heard a funny, hurt noise escape him. The breath he had been holding ran weakly out like air from a pricked balloon. The strength ran out of his legs in exactly the same way. He reached out blindly. His hand found the bench, and he did not sit, but simply plopped down on it. He was unable to take his eyes from the left rear corner of the shed, where Ev Hillman, Ann Anderson, and Bobby's good old beagle, Peter, had somehow been hung up on posts in 2 old galvanized steel shower cabinets with their doors removed. They hung there like slabs of beef on meat hooks. But they were alive, Gard saw. Somehow, some way still alive. A thick black cord, which looked like a high-voltage line or a very big coaxial cable, ran out of the center of Ann Anderson's forehead.
A similar cable ran out of the old man's right eye, and the entire top of the dog's skull had been peeled away. Dozens of smaller cords ran out of Peter's exposed and pulsing brain. Peter's eyes, free of cataracts, turned toward guard. He whined.
Jesus. Oh, my Jesus. Oh, my Jesus Christ.
He tried to get up from the bench. He couldn't. Portions of the old man's skull and Anne's skull had also been removed, he saw. The doors had been torn off the shower stalls, but they were still full of some clear liquid. It was being contained in the same way that tiny sun was contained in Bobby's water heater, he supposed. If he tried to get into one of those stalls, he would feel a tough springiness. Plenty of give, but no access.
Want to get in? I only want to get out.
Then his mind returned to its former scripture.
Jesus, dear Jesus, oh my Jesus, look at them. I don't want to look at them.
No, but he couldn't tear his eyes away. The liquid was clear but emerald green. It was moving, making that low, thick, sudsy sound. For all its clarity, Gardner thought that liquid must be very gluey indeed, perhaps the consistency of dish detergent.
How can they breathe in there? How can they be alive? Maybe they're not. Maybe it's only the movement of the liquid that makes you think they are. Maybe it's just an illusion. Please, Jesus, let it be an illusion. Peter, you heard him whine. Nope. Part of the illusion, that's all. He's hanging on a hook in a shower stall filled with the interstellar equivalent of Joy dish detergent. He couldn't whine in that. It would come out all soap bubbles, and you're just freaking out. That's what it is. Just a little visit from King Freakout.
Except he wasn't just freaking, and he knew it. Just as he knew he hadn't heard Peter whine with his ears. That hurt, helpless whining sound had come from the same place the radio music came from, the center of his brain. Anne Anderson opened her eyes.
Get me out of here,
she screamed.
Get me out of here, I'll leave her alone, only I can't feel anything except when they make it hurt, make it hurt, make it hurt.
Gardner tried again to get up. He was very faintly aware that he was making a sound, just some old sound. The sound he was making was probably a lot like the sound a woodchuck run over in the road might make, he thought. The greenish, moving liquid gave Sissy's face a gassy, ghastly corpse hue. The blue of her eyes had bleached out. Her tongue floated like some fleshy undersea plant. Her fingers, wrinkled and pruny, drifted.
I can't feel anything except when they make it hurt.
Anne wailed, and he couldn't shut her voice out, couldn't stick his fingers in his ears to make it go away, because that voice was coming from inside his head. Slish, slish, slish. Copper tubing running into the tops of the shower stalls, making them look like a hilarious combination of Buck Rogers' suspended animation chambers and Little Abner moonshine stills. Peter's fur had fallen out in patches. His hindquarters appeared to be collapsing in on themselves. His legs moved through the liquid in long, lazy sweeps, as if in his dreams he was running away.
When they make it hurt.
The old man opened his one eye.
The boy.
This thought was utterly clear, unquestionable. Gardner found himself responding to it.
What boy?
The answer was immediate. Startling for a moment, then unquestionable.
David. David Brown.
That one eye stared at him, a ceaseless sapphire with emerald tints.
Save the boy.
The boy. David. David Brown. Was he a part of this somehow, the boy they had hunted for so many exhausting hot days? Of course he was. Maybe not directly, but a part of it.
Where is he?
Gardner thought of the old man who floated in his pale green solution. Slish, slish, slish.
Altair 4,
the old man returned finally.
David's on Altair 4. Save him. And then kill us. This is... it's bad, real bad. Can't die, I've tried. We all have, even... bitch, bitch, her... This is being in hell. Use the transformer to save David, then pull the plugs. Cut the wires, burn the place, do you hear?
For the third time, Gardner tried to get up and fell bonelessly back onto the bench. He became aware that thick electrical cords were scattered all over the floor, and that brought back a ghostly memory of the band that had picked him up on the turnpike when he was coming back from New Hampshire. He puzzled at this and then got the connection. The floor looked like a concert stage just before a rock group started to play. That or a big city TV studio. The cable snaked into a huge crate filled with circuit boards and a stack of VCRs. They were wired together. He looked for a DC current converter, saw none, and then thought,
of course not, idiot. Batteries are DC.
The cassette recorders had been plugged into a mix of home computers, Ataris, Apple IIs and IIIs, TRS-80s, Commodores. Blinking on and off on the one lit screen was the word,
program.
Behind the modified computers were more circuit boards, hundreds of them. The whole thing was uttering a low, sleepy hum, a sound he associated with,
use the transformer,
big electrical equipment. Light spilled out of the crate, and the computers placed haphazardly next to it in a green flood, but the light was not quite steady. It was cycling. The pulse of the light and its relation to the sudsing sounds coming from the shower cabinets was very clear.
That's the center,
he thought with an invalid's weak excitement.
That's the annex to the ship. They come in the shed to use that. It's a transformer, and they draw their power from there. Use the transformer to save David. Might as well ask me to fly Air Force One. Ask me something easy, Pop. If I could bring him back from wherever he was by reciting Mark Twain, Poe, even, I'd take a shot. But that thing, it looks like an explosion in an electronics warehouse.
But the boy, how old, 4 or 5, and where in God's name had they put him? The sky was literally the limit.
Save the boy. Use the transformer.
There was, of course, not even any time to look closely at the damned mess. The others would be coming back. Still, he stared at the one lighted video terminal with hypnotic intensity.
Program? What if I typed Altair 4 on the keyboard?
He wondered and saw there was no keyboard. At the same second, the letters on the screen changed.
Altair 4.
It now read.
No!
His mind screamed, full of intruder's guilt.
No, Jesus, no!
The letters rippled.
No, Jesus, no!
Sweating, Gardner thought,
cancel, cancel.
Cancel, cancel. These letters blinked on and off, on and off. Gardner stared at them, horrified, then,
program.
He made an effort to shield his thoughts and tried again to get to his feet. This time he made it. Other wires came out of the transformer. These were thinner. There were, he counted, yes, 8 of them, ending in earplugs. Earplugs. Freeman Moss, the animal trainer leading mechanical elephants. Here were more earplugs. In a crazy way, it reminded him of a high school language lab.
Are they learning another language in here?
Yes.
No. They're learning to become. The machine is teaching them. But where are the batteries? I don't see any. There should be 10 or 12 big old Delcos hooked up to that thing. Just a maintenance charge running through it. There should be.
Stunned, he raised his eyes to the shower stalls again. He looked at the coaxial cable coming out of the woman's forehead, the old man's eye. He watched Peter's legs moving in those big, dreamy strides and wondered just how Bobby had gotten the dog hairs on her dress. Had she been giving Peter the equivalent of an interstellar oil change? Had she been perhaps overcome by a simple human emotion? Love? Remorse? Guilt? Had she perhaps hugged her dog before filling that cabinet up with liquid again?
There are the batteries. Organic Delcos and Ever-Readys, you might say. They're sucking them dry. Sucking them like vampires.
A new emotion crept through his fear and bewilderment and revulsion. It was fury, and Gardner welcomed it.
They make it hurt. Make it hurt. Make it hurt.
Her voice cut off abruptly. The dull hum of the transformer changed pitch, cycled down even lower. The light coming out of the crate faded a little. He thought she had fallen unconscious, thereby lowering the machine's total output by X number of what? Volts? Dynes? Ohms? Who the fuck knew?
End it, son. Save my grandson and then end it.
End of side 14. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.